Thanks, Ola. And I want to thank Ola and Andre and Robert for the invitation to let me speak here. Interesting title. It's almost like I'm inventing Esperanto for soils. Yakov came up with this title, and as I was thinking, it kind of scratched my head, you know, what does it mean, you know, in terms of doing scaling language? And actually, after a while, sometimes when you have a different kind of, when someone presents a different way of looking at your research, you can get yourself out of modes of thinking in a way and look at it differently yourself. And thinking of it as a language actually is kind of useful. And these are some work done with Yakov, a colleague of mine at where I work at David Fleischer, and a postdoc that worked with us at Rose Shilito. Some thoughts on scale. You know, scale actually confuses me quite a bit what it actually is, because it's used in so many different ways. And as a verb, it can have a meaning of to change the size of an object while maintaining its shape. And you all know, working with computers, you know, you scale something up or down, you make it bigger, smaller, zoom in on it. And it's also we can think of it as the level of detail you see when you look at an object at different levels of resolution. And that's sort of common for us in soils and such. Now, scale what is the similarity between scale and language? Why would I use this kind of metaphor? Well, the primary function of language is communication, you know, to provide information back and forth between two groups, so to speak. It also binds members of a culture or group, so it has kind of an identification issue. It identifies you with something. Well, what's the relationship then between scale and language? Well, scale provides a means to tie together diverse properties and components of a landscape. You know, we have lots of different measurement bases that we use. We have remote sensing, which are large maps, yield monitor data, and then we go in with a soil probe and we get a soil sample this size. How do we tie together like a huge field in that soil sample? And vice versa. So we usually think of scale as a measurement length or a quanta, some number, you know, that we put a value on. And we also think of scale can be considered something like a large area and a small detail, with very small detail where you've sort of zoomed in. It can be considered something like a small area with great detail. So we think of scale also as like the relationship between the size of the thing we're looking at and how much detail that encompasses. And of course, these are only rough kind of approximations. You can find an exception to these second things with detail and area, of course, so there's exceptions to that. But often, detail and scale are often confused with each other and sometimes even used interchangeably. And I struggle with that myself quite a bit, those two ideas. So measurement scale is really a side of a lot to do with providing information to us. So if we look, we look at something like this, it's a little image. You can't tell what it belongs to or what it is, but believe me, it's an R. I've sort of looked at where I got this information from. So it's actually you've zoomed in on R somehow, the letter R. So what does it mean? You know, you can take 50 of these and among it, and maybe that you might get more information. But if you zoom out a little bit, you know, take it with a bigger image, and get more information in this way, you see that it looks like maybe it's part of a set of letters, trust, you know, part of a coin. And you go up more, okay, we see it's a penny. But now we can't read the details here as well. So in analogy with soils and landscape, you might take soil samples in different parts of the landscape, and we get things like this. How do we go from, you know, and then we really want to get some idea of what this is. So the question is, how do we go from here to the coin? And what techniques are there to do that? And I'm sort of going to, what I'm going to talk about in the next 10 minutes or so is some approaches that we've used to do this. And it's actually, and I have to sort of say ahead of time, some of these approaches are really kind of specific to the conditions that we're working with, the types of soils and landscapes and things of that. But their ideas, I think, can be generalized. One is that these approaches, if you have knowledge of spatial relationships for large-scale processes, say you have a yield map and you know what the semivariogram and the variance structure of that yield map is, or you have variables affected, or a yield map is affected by soil properties, so that knowledge of the spatial structure of those large-scale images, so to speak, can be used to fill in or interpolate sparse measurements if we have a relationship there. At the same time, we can use tools like biosimulation, biophysical modeling, crop models, soil models, spatial autoregression, stochastic imaging, co-creaging or state space methods as tools for linking the large scale measurements with, say, landscape parameters and linking that with point measurements. So if we understand the correlation structure of a small scale measurement because it's related to some large scale measurement that has, there's dependence there, then we can use that spatial structure to interpolate our small scale measurements. And the landscape parameters or data or remote sensing data, so landscape parameters or data, by that I mean things like slope characteristics from a topographic map or convex, concave kind of information like that. And you can use these to link the large and small scale measurements. So sort of these, how can we go from small scale to large scale and back? Here's, I'm going to go three approaches in my talk, and these examples what these three approaches are. One is looking at continuous experimental treatments using a mixed model analysis of the treatment variable to incorporate spatial errors. And what this is, what I'm talking about here is how do you go from, a lot of us do research on plots, but really interested in making inference on a larger scale basis, say a field or something. So how do we design experiments so we can go from those plot scale measurements to something of a field scale to make inferences about what's happening in the field? Quantification of spatial structure of large scale data is, for example, to scale up measurements to small scale, small sample sizes. For example, how can we use a topographic map to find out information about the distribution of water holding capacity in the soil? And third is use of crop simulation models to back calculate operational values of small scale properties such as water holding capacity and plant properties. So we can take, this has been done by a couple of people, you take a, you know that an outcome of a on a field of a crop is yield, for example. You have a map of yields, and you want to say what is it in the environment that contributed to the yield being that particular at that particular point. What about the root depth, the water holding capacity, and things of that nature? And how can we use a crop model to sort of tell us to make inferences about that? The first thing, the example, again, going to the plot scale studies. We know that a lot of times in our plot scale experiments, we're not taking advantage of landscape interactions. We're not taking advantage of the correlation structures in the field. We try to actually block that out by blocking and remove that variance and throw it away, when in fact it could be very important. And so we lose information by not experimenting and measuring on our plots as a continuum. So in that sense, we have to go from a reductionist view where everything's reduced to single plots to sort of an agroecologic where we take into account the ecology of the system. Now this example came from, actually the idea for this came from a book that Ola and Don Nielsen had done on landscape spatial statistics. And they suggested, you know, what if we lay out continuous treatments in different kinds of formats, like a sinusoidal treatment, what would happen, what kind of yield result would we get from that? And this sounded like an intriguing question, so I decided to try it once. And we did this by considering, say we have a nitrogen rate, and you want to go a distance along a transect here, and you want to apply the nitrogen in a sinusoidal pattern. The question is, what kind of pattern is going to emerge of this, of the yield in the field? How does the soil properties sort of overlay on top of this nitrogen application rate? So what we've done is we set up a nitrogen application sort of scheme. We have to approximate discretely what these rates are because we can't do a continuous rate easily. And so we begin with the rate of 112, then 280 kilograms per hectare, 56, and 0. So we just replicate that. And we used a transect here about 140 meters long in a field in Beltsville. And this is and the crop we used was potato. And the question was, how is that going to relate to the result, the yield? Well, if you look at this field, this is actually a long strip that's about 30 meters wide. And we took some initial soil properties. It gets a little bit high in the middle, but very almost like 1.5 meters of elevation distance. What's noticeable is that there's a difference between sand and clay between the two sides of the field. Here it's a little more clay content's a little higher. Here the sand content's a little higher. So it gradates as you go up. Not much difference in plant available soil water at the first 15 centimeters. And initial soil, we did this in 2 years, initial soil nitrate was low at the beginning of each year. The first year was a little higher in this part of the field. And this is the result, if you can see the potato, where you can see actually how that pattern replicated itself, you know, from the application of the nitrogen. And this is the results of the yields, and here's our application. And you can see that in both years, you actually there's a consistency in how it reproduces, but it varies slightly. And what's really the most obvious thing is that you get the field is behaving as two different parts here. One part actually is very much less response to nitrogen than the other part of the field. And I think you can see that sinusoidal pattern both is replicated in both years. And the reason for this we believe for this yield to be higher 1 year is that there was more, the temperatures early in the season were warmer, so the potato developed slightly faster. And so the potato was getting that nitrogen before the nitrogen leached away from it. This is a very sandy soil, if you recall. We applied the nitrogen one time at the beginning of season. So with a couple of rainfalls, you're going to lose a lot of that nitrogen. And the sooner the potato plant can get it, the better it's going to be for it. So then we look at the correlation structure of those measurements. And you see that there's about 16 meters here that the correlation drops. You know, there's a significant correlation close, and there's probably about 12 meters or so here. But you see that in the middle of field, you get similar things happening, initial soil nitrate. This is for the first year. Second year, you wouldn't see this, I don't think. And this is the residuals from the yield. So if you remove the means from the yield from the treatment effects and you just get the residuals, this is the error that's not accounted for by nitrogen application. So what that means is that you see that the error actually is correlated here, and it has about the same structure as the other parameters we've measured. What's happening? Well, it looks like this soil type come in. This is our field here, and this end of the field tends to be is a different soil type. It has a little more clay. It tends to have loamy sand, silt loam textures, slightly higher slopes, about the same slope, and this is the downy Ingleside loamy, which are loamy sands. So there's a reason for this happening. Now, the other things to note here is that we have to account for autocorrelation in the means. If you just take the means of the experiment, to just take treatment means themselves, you'll find there's no spatial structure to them. They're just the same old, which you'd expect, because it's just a treatment mean. But if you remove the correlation structure due to that's imposed by the way the soils are, you tend to see that now these means are different in both sides of the field. And so you can use this correlation structure then to tell you what would be the yield in my field if I had only zero application of nitrogen. What would be the yield if I only applied 280 pounds, kilograms of N? So what we did is we took the yield response for each nitrogen treatment and mapped it on the field. And what this gives us is that it gives us four, it's almost like having four experiments in this field. You can have an experiment with zero nitrogen, with 56 kilograms per hectare, and both years the results were similar. And what this tells you is that you have one part of the field here, no matter how much nitrogen you put on, it's not responding, or it's responding in a very minimal way. This side of the field, it seems to be responding pretty well to the nitrogen. So if you want to do nitrogen management here, at this point, either you have to apply nitrogen more frequently with smaller amounts, or not apply nitrogen at all, or a minimal amount of nitrogen, because you're just going to lose it. So it's just a reiteration of what I've said. Now, the bottom part of the field had a slightly higher clay content. That was the south part to the left. And I think we believe that maybe that kept the nitrogen there just long enough for the potato plant to mobilize and use it, where it wasn't leaching quite so quickly outward. And one thing I think is that I come away from this is it's possible to possibly use nitrogen response as an analog to identify areas in a field where chemical leaching may be large. And the quantification of autocorrelation can help in this. And this is specific to our field, but then this is like an operational property, something that's happened, how a crop has responded to that soil, in a sense. The second one is we can use topographic properties, which are easy to measure and related to many other soil properties. Why is topography important? Well, it influences water flow, carries nutrients in soil, which may be deposited or removed, and it's easily measured and related to many other soil properties, these here. Surface curvature can be an important formative characteristic, and it's related to things like water availability, soil depth, and also run-on-runoff relationships. Now, we had another field we did research with, which is south of the OP cubed field at the other research site at BARC for Precision Ag. And this is the field, if you have a picture of it, and it's very slight elevation again, only about 3 or 4 meters in this, but it has kind of a complicated sort of slope curvature relief structure here. Now, if you calculate flow vectors from the slope there, you see that we have a riparian zone here, so this is where the water is being carried to. But you can see that here you have these convergent flow. These are concave areas, and the concave areas tend to be spread out from east to west. And so if you go from north to south, you find your correlation structure tends to be less than your correlation structure east to west. Now, what does that mean? Well, in this field, we had yields from a combine for 2 years, corn yields, in 1998 and 1999. You can see that this is the red are the high yields and the blue are the low yields. And you can see that you can see that structure being carried through in the yields that you got from the topographic information. Now, if you do a semivariogram of the yields, you'll find that, again, this is the semivariogram in the east-west direction across the field, and you have a much longer correlation structure than north-south. Now, this semivariogram is from the yields, and you can see it's similar to the one you probably would have gotten from the topographic structure. So here's, if you had crop yields measured not with a combine but some other way, you can see how you can use topography possibly to get an understanding of what that spatial structure is going to be. And another thing is in topography, the available water holding capacity we found, this work Yakov had done, it found that your available water holding capacity is strongly related to slope. And you see the clustering, note the clustering here, these are different transects and grids that we took the samples on. that you have to be careful to sample a wide range of areas to get a result like this. But you can use this, once you know this, you can take a topographic map and then map water holding capacity using the spatial structure of that topographic map and the values of it, and get an idea of how your soil water holding capacity maps in the field. So the correlation scale for water holding capacity is likely to be similar to that for the topographic variables, given the relationship there, and gives us a way of mapping it, which I don't have time to show any more on that. The last thing is using a simulation model to provide information on estimated relative effects of soil properties on observed yields. So we ask our question, what's the value of a specific soil property would have resulted in observed yield? So we take into account the effects of weather and the interaction with topography, can be used to optimize or back calculate soil properties to help explain crop yield variability. And a yield map can be used, we used in the objective function. So we varied the soil water holding capacity to match what the yield we measured in the yield map in the combine. I've used a very simple model in this case. We took into account the effect of water availability on yields on corn yield, and nothing much else. It's a very simple water budget model and a simple profile. This kind of work has been done by, PAWS used a series maze to optimize soil drainage rate and rooting depth, and they attempted to explain yield variability due to excess or deficient water. And they had pretty good results with that, too. And, of course, this operational, we say, what you're getting is something that for management purposes, it may be good, but it may not reflect what's actually there. I'll explain in a moment. So these are two yield maps. We got estimated water holding capacities from yield maps. And you can see from the 2 years, they're quite similar, and they show that these areas up here, which has low yields, a low water holding capacity of the low yields, the blue area is associated with higher available water. And you can see the relation again with the spatial structure going across there in east to west in the riparian zone that's here. So if you looked at the estimated water holding capacity, we measured water holding capacity at the surface in cores and just plotted that against what we estimated from the yield from this corn from this method with the model. And you say there's a good kind of coarse correspondence. But one thing you notice, if you look at a yield versus water holding capacity, it'll go to an asymptote, because you get to a certain water holding capacity, it's not going to affect yield anymore. And that's the same thing. The crop model is going to give you the same results. So don't expect to get water holding capacities in a high range that are meaningful, because it could fit anything there, because at high water holding capacities, you're going to get high yields or anyway. And so that we give not a true water holding capacity, but it is a good analog of water availability that one could use to make management decisions about things. Another thing that this might contribute to this water holding capacity is upward movement of water from a water table could also contribute to this. So it's one field, you have different kind of conditions like that. So if you use these computer simulation models, can I use to analyze yield monitor data, provide information on soil properties. And you see in this yield map we hear, according to a remotely sensed image, that there's correspondence between this is the blue with the lower yields here, and this corresponds to this sort of open area, and the higher yields you can see is more dense colors. So this is more opportunity to incorporate a range of information to understand what's going on. So topographic information can be used to fill in or interpolate sparse measurements of soil properties. And topography can be used to help interpret yield maps in terms of soil variability and develop site-specific management practices based on that variability. Incorporating a lot of information to get them you want to get your sources talking to each other. And then they'll tell you information that each one will tell you its own kind of information. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Vanessa. Please, questions?
Tim. I think that's a problem. Yeah, I agree with you. And that's why having other information there, things like weather, parent material would have a big effect. You know, what's the soil textures there? And that's one way to account for that. Parent material, climate, and those kinds of things. I think, and soil depth. That's why I don't know how to answer that more fully. That's why I said the limitation. A lot of this stuff is site-specific, but you want to get as much. Sometimes the generality of that is maybe on a larger scale.
Are there any further questions? Well, if not, then let's thank our speaker again.
Please, thank you, Arthur. Thank you.
And our next speaker from Saskatchewan, Canada, is Asim Biswas, and he is going to speak about